Gabel Show with Seth, Dan, and Randeep on Sportsnet 650.
Hour three of the People's Show, Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah, and Randeep Janda. Lots still to come. And we'll continue our football conversation with Mark Schofield later this hour. Dive into the Patriots game plan.
Oh, the Pats.
Yeah.
They're good, man.
Sat's got a new crush.
Not a crush. It's just analysis.
Yeah.
Just straight up analysis about why they're as good as they are.
And they've been dominant, certainly lately. Have to love when a team just like is going to punch you in the mouth for the entire night. And that's what they did to the Buffalo Bills, who were rattled after the game by every question.
Old school. Have you ever seen a home team ever rattle at a home,
no.
at their home stadium? It's like they were just shook.
Man, it's you know exactly what they're going to do, and yet you can't stop them. It's one of the most frustrating things you can have in a sports matchup. Ian McIntyre is going to join us in a couple of moments. When you think about yesterday and the message from the owner, Francesco Aquilini, how much do we believe? Is that fair to ask that question? I mean, of course, you're never going to get all of the answers, as Jim Benning would tell us. You guys don't have all the information. Well, you're not going to get everything. But how much was fair to take away from what we heard yesterday, especially from the owner, Francesco Aquilini?
The biggest thing I saw, I mean, the first thing is the acknowledgement of the culture not being good enough here and that they hadn't built what they needed to build as a program. And he did acknowledge that and say, yeah, that's some of the things that he learned. And to me, that's the main thing here. And the word culture is a buzz phrase. It's easy to say. But for an organization to talk so much about it under Lyndon and Benning's regime, and even more so with Benning when Lyndon went away, they failed at building that. So what you really have to do is have a proper plan about what you want this team to be and then set that culture. And if you can acknowledge that and understand that, then maybe you can make better decisions moving forward. But you have to truly believe that moving forward.
It is the People's Show. He is the People's Triple Threat on radio, on television, on digital. It's Ian McIntyre. IMac, what's up?
You guys need to agree on my moniker because Sat actually calls me the quadruple threat, and you're just giving me a triple threat. So 3.5 threat 3.5.
Yep. Maybe. I mean, I have called you the quadruple threat in the past. I did like some of the nature photography from your drive to the bubble last year. The beautiful elk you found along the way.
Thank you. Nothing's as catchy as Bruce. There it is, though.
We can think of something, IMac. Give us time.
Hi, Randy.
Nice to chat again.
Now, do you call me quad or triple?
You're the infinite threat. You've got so many talents, IMac. You predicted the Juho Lamico goal yesterday as I was sitting next to you.
Thank you for the credit for that, by the way. I also said the game before that Brock would score, but I got that one wrong. I was off by a night.
Yeah, you were a game early.
But I did tell, and someday if you have Tim Horvat on, he'll back me up. I did tell him in Ottawa last week that Bo was probably going to get a goal that night, which he did. So I'm on a pretty good roll. I'm 2 for 3. If the Canucks were 2 for 3 since the start of the season, we wouldn't have all this stuff to talk about this week.
All right, IMac. So when I text you tomorrow asking who's going to score, like make sure to give it to me before puck drop so I can get that play in for tomorrow night.
All right. I don't have a strong feeling every game, but some games I do.
All right. Last night, it's hard to imagine a night going better given the situation here in Vancouver, but what was your main takeaway from night one of the new era?
Oh, just the flow of oxygen through the building, that people could breathe again, because this debilitating black cloud had finally dissipated, and whether they were going to win or not last night, you could sense that there was some energy and relief and hopefulness and excitement, which I guess is what you're always hoping for in a coaching change. But that stuff doesn't last too long if the team doesn't play better. And at least for one night, they played better. They got a bounce. You know, they got what teams often see when a new coach comes in, and now it's a matter of how long we're going to see this. Is this really a new team? I mean, the roster hasn't changed. We know there's some serious flaws there. But if we see that kind of intensity and speed and freeness, I guess, would be a word that you could use with which the Canucks played last night, maybe they'll win a bunch of games.
You know, the thing that really stood out to me today was just hearing the vibe the players had and some of the things they kind of mentioned. And even if it's a small thing, just being a bit more aggressive, and like Quinn mentioned, that the forwards are being asked that they can go behind the nets and push a bit more. And one of the things that JT mentioned was, you know, we're allowed to have more freedom as long as we, you know, do back check hard and do all those sort of things. It seems like a small, minor tweak, because for the most part, the systems are the same. It's simply just about how far you want to push your forecheck. But it certainly seems like the players are really receptive to the new message.
Well, they've been freed up, and there's another form of the word free. They've been freed up to basically be as aggressive as they like. You know, the thing about Boudreaux is he just wants his team to play at speed all the time, and he talked about that in his delightful session with reporters today. Man, this guy's going to be a hoot to talk to every day. Maybe not so much if they start losing again, but he's awfully funny and bright and witty in some of his observations. But when he talked about, you know, trying to stop the other team in their zone instead of your zone, you know, defending in the offensive zone, and then if that doesn't work, then you try and defend in the neutral zone, and the third option, the least desirable, is you defend in your own zone. And so he wants the players to be aggressive and moving forward. And I had a chance to talk to Scotty Walker today as well, who's by the way, he's a great story. Like this guy and what his career path has been through. And he was with the Canucks both as a player and then the player development part of things. And now he's just incredibly excited to be here as a coach with Boudreaux. But he said, you know, they want their guys to play 100 miles an hour. And if you do that often enough, he said, the players at this level, their brains will just kind of turn off, and they play on instinct because everything's happening so fast. Once they get used to that pace and that style, and he said, if they make mistakes, then that's fine. What they don't want is guys playing at half speed and coming to a stop and starting to try to think about what they're supposed to be doing and where they might go with the puck. He says that's when you make more mistakes, but those are the mistakes they don't want. They want just guys to be going and pushing and forcing the other team and putting the other team under pressure. And if mistakes happen, they can live with them as long as the players acknowledge the mistakes and try not to repeat them. But they don't want a team playing tentatively. They don't want a team on its heels. So we'll see how this goes. I mean, part of the reason the Canucks were playing differently this year is because they had been so poor at defending last year when they were supposedly this high-scoring offensive team. And, you know, scoring at times was the problem, but we all know the bigger problem was how many goals they were surrendering last year. So we'll see if this works. Can they be a really good offensive team and still keep the puck out of their net enough to win? We're going to find out.
IMAC, you know, that message of being aggressive or playing, you know, a little tougher game is something that Stan Smeal mentioned to us in the 6 p.m. hour yesterday, where he said, initiate. We want this team to initiate more, not maybe sit back or wait for the game to come to them. You know, Smeal, in the last 24 hours, there's been a lot of takes on sports radio about, you know, the press conferences yesterday, but he comes away looking like, you know, Mr. Canuck, kind of what he's been in this market for years, but just a very passionate individual that for a while there it looked like you weren't sure where he was in the organization. He was a special advisor, but you know, how prominent was he? This is quite the return for Stan Smeal and clearly a key part of this organization going forward.
Yeah, well, a year ago, there was no media guide, just as there physically is no media guide this year, but it is online. And a year ago, he suddenly disappeared from the Canucks media guide. And I remember calling him and asking, is everything okay? Are you still with the organization? And we had a pretty good talk, and there were, you know, some things going on and some things in his personal life as well. But, no, he was fine, and he was still, you know, in an advisory role and still going to the games and at the rink. But clearly, you know, it wasn't in the latter stages of the Benning regime. It just wasn't the job that he had had earlier. That was the sense that I got. And, you know, Stan has devoted his life, his adult life, and that's not hyperbole. I mean that literally. From junior hockey to being drafted by the Canucks to making them as a rookie, I think he was 20 in 1978, to playing his entire career for the Canucks, a career that, by the way, was shortened significantly by injuries incurred in the manner in which he sacrificed himself for the organization as a player, yet he still left as the team's all-time leading scorer. You know, before there was Naslund and Linden and the Sedins, there was Stan Smeal, and he immediately went to work for the team. And for a while, it was through in the coaching ranks, and then he sort of shifted to management, and he is still with them. And I can say, as anyone who remembers watching that team, and I was just a teenager in the 1980s, and those were some of the worst teams. Like, if we think the Canucks are bad now, you should have seen how bad they were at times in the 1980s. Yet Smeal was always a guy who just battled absolutely every night, even when winning was kind of hopeless. And there weren't, you know, in hindsight, there weren't a whole bunch of guys. There weren't enough of those guys back then. And really, over the course of 50 years, when you think about people who you know, proverbially bled Canuck colors, there's not all that many of them, but there certainly was Stan Smeal, and he still bleeds those colors. And I think that passion and that devotion is what came through in the press conference yesterday, because Stan is a soft-spoken guy. For as abrasive and miserable as he was on the ice as a player to play against, he is a very kind of soft-spoken guy. And, you know, I don't see him get angry. I haven't seen him be angry off the ice. I haven't seen him really get worked up or be really loud. He's just kind of a quiet guy. At least that's the way he carries himself in his post-playing career. But you could really feel that passion for this organization and for what he thinks a Canuck, being a Canuck, should represent and the ideals that players should embrace when they're wearing a Canuck jersey, I think that really came through in the press conference. So I thought it was probably one of his finest days as a Vancouver Canuck, and there's been a whole lot of them over the last 40 years.
Ian McIntyre, our guest here on the People's Show. It was refreshing to hear Stan and just talk straight from the heart about the passion and the pride that he has for this organization and where it's gone. And as Francesco mentioned yesterday, you know, culture is one of the big things that he feels needs to be instilled within this organization right now. You know, I guess we can dwell on where that's gone, but I guess the bigger question is, how do they go about fixing that and, you know, recognizing and rectifying these mistakes that they've made in the past?
Yeah, well, accountability seems to be the buzzword, right? And that was mentioned yesterday, and it was mentioned by the players before Aquilini and Smeal ever had their press conference. You know, the players who came out kind of volunteered that this was now something that they were going to have to hold themselves to. And, you know, I think that accountability is another part of the culture. And, you know, Stan was very honest as well in the press conference where he talked about, you know, things can get so bad that you point fingers. And, you know, people have talked about communication, and we saw a difference in some of the players last night. You know, a member of their management staff told me that you have to have a will. Like, if you're going to change your culture by making players more accountable and making them do things that they haven't had to do, there has to be a will to do that. And now, right now, you know, with Bruce Boudreau, who is beholden to nobody, he's here on a 2-year contract. He's inherited this team. He doesn't owe anybody anything other than he owes the Aquilinis, you know, his best effort, because I'm sure he'd like to coach more than this season or this season and next. It seems there's a will now to make players accountable and hold them to a higher standard. And if you have enough people insisting on that and you get enough players adhering to that, then your culture will change. But it takes a will to do it. And right now, I think there is a will.
Well, and that will is certainly there, right? And it is a big difference. Now, long-term moving forward, I asked Francesco what lesson he's kind of learned over the past 7 or bit years and how he can apply that moving forward. He mentioned culture and all that sort of stuff. How much optimism should there be that they get the future of this organization right when it comes to the next hire and building out the front office?
Yeah, well, that remains to be seen, and that's a big question mark. It, you know, after one game, it seems they got the coach right.
Yeah.
I think Bruce Boudreau is exactly what this team needed. The general manager hire is probably a lot harder and a lot trickier, and that's why that one's taking time. And, you know, I don't know. I can't answer that. I wish I could say, oh, yeah, they're going to hire the best possible guy. You know, sometimes those guys have choices of where they want to go if they're that highly coveted, that highly regarded, and maybe some won't want to come and coach here. So I can't answer that. But what I can say from observation is, if you're talking about building culture, which is what Aquilini said in response to your question, Sat, well, you know, the culture, it's kind of, you know, it means a lot of things.
Yes.
But included in that, and I mentioned accountability, it means character as well. And it means unselfishness and sacrifice and loyalty. And when you look at the management group that they now have in place on an interim basis, it absolutely it is overflowing with those ideals. You know, when you think about the Sedins and Ryan Johnson and Doug Jarvis and Chris Gere and, of course, Stan, who we've already been talking about, I mean, these people epitomize character and professionalism and putting the team first. So if that is kind of the template, the component of what the Aquilinis are looking for in their leadership group, then I think there's a pretty good chance that they're going to hire a general manager and hopefully a president as well, who have and share those same ideals.
Before we let you go, well, the big development last night was some of the different looks we saw on the penalty kill, right? And, man, maybe it's just Pettersson had more jump in his step last night. We've seen him have it for a game or two in the past this season, but he wasn't able to sustain it. But it did feel like once he had that penalty kill shift, I started to see more of the Elias Pettersson I normally expect to see. Did you feel that way too?
Yeah, but I also think that Elias has been getting better incrementally. It just has been frustratingly slow, and he's still not where he would admit he needs to be. But he has been getting better. the guy that I thought had a more profound improvement based on what he had shown recently was Brock Besser. Like, that's the best I've seen Besser skate, the most engaged I've seen him in puck battles and puck pursuit. And, you know, it got talked about a lot about Boudreaux's advice for him to shoot, and he did shoot more, and he ends up with a goal for the first time, you know, in it felt like forever. I think it was 13 games, 14 games. And, you know, I saw a lot of guys who were kind of that way, a lot more engaged. You know, even Bo Horvat, who always plays hard, but, you know, diving for pucks to get them out of the zone or to push them to a teammate. But, you know, Pettersson is such a proud guy and has gotten here to this point in his career by proving people wrong and sort of nurturing that chip on his shoulder to do the things that people say, well, you know, yeah, good player, but he's this or he's that, can't do this, can't do that. He has made it here by proving those people wrong. So if the idea is that he really thinks he can be a penalty killer and should be on the penalty kill, and people haven't given him that chance, and they might not give him the chance or might not have given him the chance, not because they don't think he's couldn't do it, but maybe they think he's too valuable in other areas to have him standing in front of shots. Whatever it is, if Pettersson feels like this is something that he should be doing and nobody has given him that chance and a lot of people don't think he can do it, then he's going to be fired up to prove those people wrong, because that's what he's done at every level and every point in his career until now.
IMAC, I'll be looking for that goal scorer for tomorrow night, okay?
Do I get a share of the winnings?
Only if it's a winner.
IMAC likes to be paid in scotch, by the way. High-end scotch, right?
Whiskey, yeah, that always works.
I can give you an iron brew.
Wine is okay. Iron brew I would take. Walker's shortbread as well.
How about haggis?
Haggis is okay. Haggis gets a bad rap. Don't get me started on haggis.
All right.
Save that for another show.
Okay. Thanks, IMAC.
Is haggis a brunch meal?
We lost him on that one.
Yeah, there's
it's like, I'm good. I'm not answering these idiots.
No, you know, Saturday
we had enough egg talk with Donnie. Now we're going into haggis with IMAC.
No, we were kind of having fun during the game yesterday, and Lamico was playing, and we're like, this guy, is he really going to score? And boom, here we go. Boom.
Lammy,
the guy that now Bruce Boudreau knows his name.
Well, he came so close.
The kind fourth liner.
That kindly fourth liner. I'm like, Boudreau, you're the best. But what was it? Lamico hit, got a shot off the post as well. Yes, you could have had two.
Could have had a couple. Could have had a brace, a doppietta even. But it didn't happen for Juho Lamico.
Okay. IMAC was talking about the 80s. I love this text that just came in not too long ago, actually. It was regarding the 80s. So it was unsigned, put your name on it. IMAC talking about those dismal teams during the early years. My immigrant dad first experienced a hockey game back then and never went back. Just imagine having your first hockey experience when the team is just awful.
Yep.
Awful. Like, imagine being a Colorado Avalanche fan when they were just absolute dog bleep that. Remember those couple of years when actually Obi was on that team?
The shortened season.
The Joe Sacco. Yeah. I believe Joe Sacco was the head coach. Just imagine being a fan, like a new fan. I can't wait to watch these guys. And it's just terrible.
Yeah.
Like, probably.
So like the last few years of the Canucks.
They've been awful, but they haven't been like, I was going to say historically bad, but that PK has been historically bad.
Detroit from a couple of years ago. That was a really bad hockey.
Pick an Ottawa year.
Yep. Fair enough. It's time for the People's Trivia here on Sportsnet 650. Your chance to win a pair of tickets to the Canucks and Boston Bruins for tomorrow night, December the 8th. It's a 6 p.m. puck drop. These are lower bowl seats. We give you a question. You answer it. 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. One correct answer gets an entry into the draw for these tickets. Randeep, what is our question?
Today's question is, Elias Pettersson has one career hat trick. Who did it come against? Who did that hat trick come against?
All right. Answer it.
I think I know this one.
Oh, do you? It's a little easier than Sat's question the other day.
Hey, that went all right. That went all right. Listen, you got to...
Anytime Harold Drukin's the answer, it's a It's a bit of a reach.
No, it's not. It's not a reach, Dan. You're out of your element of this one.
Your Toronto is showing, Dan.
Canucks fans in the 2000s remember the Harold Druckin goal because there were a lot of dark times, man, until he scored that goal that made the playoffs.
Yeah, Druckin was a Leaf too, but he just was remembered more here in Vancouver.
Because it was like dark times. You know how Ian was talking about there's been a lot of dark times up until the West Coast Express.
Yeah.
And the Sedins, you know, the West Coast. You know, it was a lot of dark times.
Man,
you know?
I was more of an Andrew Castles guy myself. But
Than Brandon Morrison?
It's the People's Show. Answer that question with the People's Trivia, and you might be going to tomorrow night's game against the Bruins. Up next, Mark Schofield on Sportsnet 650.
This is the People's Show on the official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Here's Dan, Sat, and Randeep.
Yeah, the People's Show. You can get it on podcast, Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts. Appreciate you leaving a nice 5-star review with a message as well. If you leave the nice message, we'll probably read it on air, as long as you keep it PG. You want to make a joke about my height? Yep, go ahead. Take a number.
Get in line.
Get in line.
You know what's going to happen now, right? Mm. That's going to be the thing.
Yep.
That's going to be the thing. You could have said, hey, give us a recipe. Maybe give us your favorite egg recipe.
Yeah.
Like, you know, breakfast.
Yes. Let me know about eggs.
Oh, but no, he came with the height. So now everybody's going to go and give us a 5-star review, which is great. But they're going to go with the height.
Leave a 5-star review with your favorite egg recipe for...
You can't change the channel now.
For Sat to try.
Mm-hmm.
I got one for
Heck,
you.
Heck, I'd try it.
I got one for you, Sat.
I'll even TikTok it. Anyways, go ahead.
It's called Anda Bread. It's a Punjabi street food. All so basically, you throw some like masala, as we call it, and some spices. It's an omelet in bread. No, you don't have to make it spicy.
Okay,
you can. It's up to you on how much spice you want to do. But it's a staple in every Punjabi household.
I thought you told me every Punjabi food is like super spicy.
No, you can make it for kids.
Okay.
So yeah, we're going to give Sat the kid recipe.
Can't confirm. I use the kid recipe too.
Yeah.
Does it come with crayons?
No. It comes with a scolding to eat your food quietly in the corner, like most Punjabi households.
Sit down and eat it.
Sit down, shut up, and eat your food.
Or with your 5-star review, leave a review on Dud Soda and how great it is to try.
That will work too.
And we'll read it on air. But also coming up tomorrow, we'll be giving away a pair of lower bowl seats to podcast listeners only to the upcoming Canucks game. But today we did it with the People's Trivia and the question. Elias Pettersson has one career hat trick. Who did it come against? The correct answer being the Ottawa Senators. And our lucky winner is Lincoln in Surrey. Lincoln, shouts to you. One of many to get the correct answer, but Raja picked your name out of the hat for today. You're going to the Canucks and Bruins tomorrow. Nice
shouts
job.
Shouts to Lincoln.
Yeah. Attaboy.
We've got like a full variety.
That was rookie season Elias Pettersson. That was fun, Elias Pettersson.
Oh, yeah. That was the first game, first shift, first shot, Calgary season. That was a lot of great things happened that year.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, just maybe, we'll return to that.
Yeah. We just got a text here saying Zegras just set up the goal of the century, Jeremy and Langley. Yeah, we were like school children yelling, watching that video between the break. I am stunned. So for those who have not seen it, make sure when you get a chance to check out Trevor Zegras' assist to Sonny Milano in the Ducks game against the Buffalo Sabres happening right now. He essentially flipped the puck behind the net.
Yeah.
Over the net to Milano, who bats it into the goal. And I'm not doing it justice because he tried to do the lacrosse. It looked like Zegras behind the net was trying to do the lacrosse
goal. He was
goal.
Going for the Michigan.
That's what he was trying to do.
He essentially made everybody think he was going for the Michigan. But instead of carrying the puck and trying to whip it into the net himself, he flipped it over the net to Milano.
He flipped it like a pancake over the net.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a float, boys. It was so majestic, man. This kid's a wizard.
He's unreal. Remember what I said before the season? He's my breakout star of the year.
Yeah.
That's my guy, Trevor Zegras.
As the season goes on.
I think in the summer, there was a point where he was like plus 2,000 to win the Calder.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's him and Lucas Raymond right now.
Yeah.
Like, that's going to be, as the season goes...
Sider, too.
Morton Sider, but you know how defensemen don't get that same love, especially if you've got two high-scoring forwards, right? Like, I love the defenseman conversation, but we know which direction this is probably going to go if they both stay healthy.
We'll get back into the hockey talk coming up in a little bit, but let's bring in our next guest. It is Mark Schofield, our QB analyst on The People's Show. You can check him out on Twitter by his name and on YouTube. Mark Schofield as the channel.
And Mark is, from what I understand, very distraught right now because he let pasta water go down the drain without using it.
Oh, no.
Mark, are you okay?
Look, this Trevor Zegras assist has pulled me out of a slump that I was in from wasting some pasta cooking water, because I got to tell you, look, it's the second time in like 3 days. I made bolognese Sunday night and I lost the cooking water. So I had to like sort of loosen the sauce with just, you know, some other water. And then tonight I was making a primavera. Again, same thing. You pour the pasta cooking water you're supposed to reserve to help loosen the sauce every single time. It just goes down the drain. I can't figure it out.
The power of pasta water. I mean, it's just like, it's incredible what that stuff can do.
Mm. It's magical.
It's The People's Show. Mark Schofield, our QB analyst, joins us every Tuesday. How about that Patriots game plan last night, Mark?
Well, I mean, it certainly doesn't give me a lot of work to do. I mean, I like to do, although I will say it made my life a little easier this morning, because you guys know I do the three throws series on Twitter where I break down three throws from a quarterback. I didn't have to look hard for the three throws to highlight for Mac Jones, because there are only three to choose from. And I will say near the end of the game, I was kind of sweating it out. Like, if they throw a fourth pass, like, how am I going to leave one out? Like, how do I leave one on the cutter room floor? Like, what am I going to do in that situation? But, I mean, it was quintessential Bill Belichick. It was 55-mile-an-hour wind gusts. He probably saw the first pass attempt for Mac Jones, which was into the wind, a 5-yard route from Jonnu Smith to the flat that probably covered 10 yards from quarterback to receiver, but Jonnu Smith had to, like, Odell Beckham Jr. it over his head because the pass fails because of the wind. Belichick probably looked at that and said, now, if we could go the rest of the way without throwing a ball, I'll be perfectly fine with it. But it was a game that set up the way New England wanted, you know? If you look at Buffalo, what do they do well? They throw the ball. What do they struggle doing? Stopping the run. And so if you had given Bill Belichick an incubator to create a perfect environment to play the Buffalo Bills last night, he would have probably created what we saw. A windy night where the passing game is going to be impacted. Even somebody with an absolute cannon for a right arm of Josh Allen, the ball would still move on his throws. I mean, the back shoulder throw he tried to Stephon Diggs late in the game, he threw it as hard as he possibly could, and it still moved probably 5 yards from where he wanted to put it to behind the receiver because of the wind gust. And so from Belichick's perspective, I mean, this was an ideal scenario for him. He could run it down their throats as much as he wanted to, not ask Mac Jones to do a lot. Now, big picture, did we learn a lot about those two teams? I really don't think so. I don't think it's a situation where you can say, oh, well, New England's clearly the better team. I think last night in that situation they were, and we'll learn a little bit more about these two teams 3 weeks from now when they meet again.
Well, you know, I want to just focus on Belichick and that team overall, because I know we talked about this in previous weeks as well, but every week that goes by, their advantage becomes greater and greater. Colder weather, tougher conditions, and they beat the heck out of you in the trenches. And the running game, they have so many guys that can hurt you in the way they play. And defensively, that's a tough piece of business at pretty much every single level. How dangerous is this Patriots team right now in the AFC as we head to the stretch run?
You know, Seth, I think this year, when you look at the seven teams that are in right now, and again, it will probably change. In all likelihood, it will change what seven teams are in. But, you know, whether it's New England, whether it's Tennessee, Kansas City, Baltimore, Chargers, Cincinnati, the Bills, there's not a perfect team in that group. You know, every team sort of has a question mark. But I think when you look at what New England is able to do up front on both sides of the ball, you know, the way they can – you know, you watch whether it's the game against Atlanta, whether it's the game against Tennessee, whether it was last night, the way they move the line of scrimmage in their favor, whether they're on offense or in defense, right? You know, if they're on defense, they're pushing guys back. Josh Allen had, you know, there were moments last night when they would just rush three or four and still get pressure and move Josh Allen off the spot. Obviously, what they did in the run game, they're so physical, they're so overwhelming in the run game. And I think this is something that really Belichick has been building over the past couple of seasons. You look at, you know, the last Super Bowl run they had, they became that sort of physical two-back, full-back lead team down the stretch and certainly into the playoffs. That's how they kind of beat the Chargers in the divisional round. That's certainly what they relied on to beat the Chiefs for the most part in that AFC Championship game, and then what they did against the Rams. And you look at what they're doing now, it's, again, that physical run game. And what's interesting about it is part of the reason that they wanted to do that last night, Buffalo is primarily a nickel defense with two linebackers. They had to get a third linebacker onto the field. May basically for the first time for any sustained period of plays all season. And during this era where, as we all know, the passing game is king and it's more efficient on a expected points added basis to throw the ball, with every defense then responding in terms of how do we stop the pass? We're going to get lighter. We're going to get more athletic. Now you have a team in New England that they want to be bigger. They're going to be two running backs with a fullback. They're going to be two tight ends. Last night they were basically playing with six offensive linemen, using Michael Owendu as that tight end and a sixth offensive lineman. And they were just saying, look, play with guys you're not comfortable with playing. Get a third linebacker onto the field for the first time all season. You know, try to play heavy or try to stop us when you play in your base defense, which is four down, two linebackers, five defensive backs. We've now zigged when the rest of the league has zagged in this smaller, lighter, athletic passing game direction. And right now it's really working for them. Can they sustain it? It looks like they can. You know, the question is a big one. If they get into a game with, say, Kansas City or the Chargers or, you know, whatever team you want to think about in the playoffs, and it turns into a kind of a shootout, can they score points enough to keep up? Or is their defense going to be good enough to stop these teams? Maybe it will be, but that still remains to be seen. That's sort of their question mark. If they get into a game where they have to throw it, can they win that? Or can they simply prevent a shootout type scenario with their defense?
Well, you mentioned KC, and they took care of business against Denver. They've won five straight. But when you look at this team and playing against good teams that have a strong offense, can they continue to win with a low-scoring offense? Is that something that is in this team's, you know, our repertoire now?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like right now they can kind of win games that way. You know, Kansas City's so interesting because earlier in the season, you know, and we talked about it on this show, there was the defense that was struggling and the offense felt like they needed to hit it out of the park every drive. They had to finish every drive with home runs and that were touchdowns. And that sort of led to a lot of the mistakes you saw from Patrick Mahomes. And now in recent weeks, what's happened? The defense figured things out. They acquire Melvin Ingram, which, you know, maybe he's not the world's best edge, but it's allowed them to kick Chris Jones inside where he's much more productive, and that's helped shore up their defensive front. They've sort of figured things out in the secondary. Even Daniel Sorensen, who's been given a lot of criticism for how he's played at the safety spot, had a big play against Denver. And so it seems like they've figured things out defensively, but there's still sort of this lingering question about, okay, what about the offense? Like, are they going to be able to get back to anywhere close to the production we thought they were going to have? Maybe they get there, maybe they don't. And if they don't, they're going to have to almost have a New England-esque formula, right? And while the Patriots have shown over their years that they can do that, that's not really something we've seen from Kansas City. So in essence, their offense and whether they can win low-scoring games or score enough is a question mark for them. And that's a weird question mark to have. If you would have told me back in August that, you know, when we get to December, we're going to be worried about the Chiefs from an offensive perspective, I would have said that was absurd. That was crazy. But that's kind of where we're at. And, you know, they'll probably be in a decent enough position to win that division. You know, maybe they, you know, put it together offensively down the stretch and into the playoffs and through the playoffs to make another run. But that is their biggest question right now. What are we going to see from them offensively down the stretch? Will they be able to figure out all the cover two looks and the two safety looks and the sort of coverage shells that have given them problems to date?
Mark Schofield, our guest. How have the Chargers and Justin Herbert got it back on track?
They really pushed it downfield. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, and this has been sort of a lot of us on the outside looking in have been wondering about, okay, well, you look at what Justin Herbert did last year with attacking downfield, and you see this offense under offense coordinator Joe Lombardi, where he's obviously in that sort of West Coast background, learned under Sean Payton, and you see a lot of those concepts in the passing game. How are they going to marry what Herbert does well in terms of his arm talent and throwing downfield with that kind of offensive philosophy. And you started to see it, even that game they lost 2 weeks ago against the Denver Broncos, you started to see sort of a marriage of what they do sort of in New Orleans with the quick game stuff, with some three-level reads and more vertical concepts, you know, splitting the field in half, giving a quick game concept to one side, a more vertical route concept to the other side. So they were in the process of figuring out, and they really sort of figured it out against Cincinnati. I mean, Herbert, you know, he missed a couple of throws, but they let him really push the ball downfield. I think coming into this week, his average depth of target was something like 7.4. And against the Bengals, it was like 10.7. You know, they really cranked up the downfield throws for him. And that's where he's at his best because, you know, as we'll talk about later, his arm talent, it's incredible. And what he can do in the downfield passing game, what he can do rolling, sliding, rolling, moving to one side and then throwing back to the other side of the field. I mean, the touchdown throw to Guyton, which I think covered 62.5 yards in the air. And granted, it was more of a jump ball by the end of it, but to roll outside the right numbers and throw back to the left sideline the way they did, that's alien kind of stuff. And so they finally figured out, I think, over the past couple of weeks, a way to marry the philosophical approach that Joe Lombardi has with the quick game stuff with some vertical opportunities for Justin Herbert to play to his strengths, to push the ball downfield. And I think now that they've figured that part out, I think offensively the Chargers are going to be fine. Like the question with them is more on the defensive side. Can they stop the run? If they get into a game like New England, are they just going to, you know, have the ball three times over the course of the game because New England's just going to dominate them up front in the run game? But offensively, I think the Chargers have pieced together what's going to work for them down the stretch.
Now, when we look at the Arizona Cardinals, because that's a team as well that we talked a little bit about, okay, they have success, they have a really good young quarterback, but is the plan, does it always make sense, especially with Murray? And he missed a few weeks with an injury, he was back and didn't miss a beat, right? They beat the Bears, he does it with his feet, he does it in the air game, but then you kind of watch what they look like with Colt McCoy under Cliff Kingsbury. The offense looked a lot different. And as much as we want to sit here and say, okay, I'd like to see them get some more easier wins and find ways to go downfield differently as opposed to kind of just having Kyler Murray going out there and playing arcade football all the times. But is it maybe the reason they're doing this, that this is the best way to get Kyler Murray at his best, and that if you implement things that take him away from that, you may not get the same level of play from him? And I'm really curious to get your thoughts about that, the overall philosophy of that offense. And maybe it is more about Cliff Kingsbury taking his hands off the wheel and understanding this is what Kyler Murray might need.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about that. I think there's a lot when you sort of study this offense and you watch it. It's like, okay, well, they clearly have in their playbook defined concepts and plays that they know, look, within structure, there will be opportunities for the quarterback to make reads A, B, and C and go through his progressions and, you know, stay within the confines of the pocket and make something happen. But they've clearly, like you said, you know, allowed Murray and sort of to use the phrase, you know, taking the hands off the wheel from Kingsbury's perspective. Look, if you see something you like, if you see an opportunity that you want to take advantage of, if you know, see a defensive look that makes you think, look, I can come off those reads and make something happen backside by rolling around a little bit or moving around, buying some time, then do it. You know, play this game the way you want to play it. You know, have a sort of open play style. And I think, you know, finding that balance is sometimes difficult. We're trying to find that balance between structure in your offense, you know, for progression reads and things like that, and catering to a quarterback that thrives outside of the pocket, outside of structure, and sort of that chaos. And I think that's been part of the push and pull between the, you know, coach and offense and quarterback over the past couple of seasons with Cliff and Kyler. But it seems like they've got the right mix right now. It seems like they've got that right balance between, all right, you know, let's make some things happen. You know, we'll let you do what you want to do, slide around, move around, use your legs, create some opportunities. But obviously still that there will be moments where you'll have to make throws and reach from the pocket. And Kyler has shown over this year that he could do that as well at a very high level. And so adding the weapons that they've added, I think, is a big part of that. You know, it's one thing when it's Kyler and it's DeAndre Hopkins, and those are really the two guys. And you know, from a defensive perspective, you understand, okay, you take away DeAndre Hopkins and he's going to struggle to create opportunities downfield. Now you've got more weapons to worry about. The addition of Zach Ertz, I think, has certainly helped. Christian Kirk has played a big role. AJ Green has played a big role. And so now there's more to worry about from a defensive perspective. And it also gives Kyler more opportunities in those moments to find players downfield. So I think they finally found the right mix of, you know, weapons and the right balance between the structure and the off structure that has made that offense difficult to defend.
You're listening to The People Show. We're joined by Mark Schofield. Mark, for Week 13, what was your throw of the week?
Yeah, we'll go back to Justin Herbert. And, you know, whether it was the one to Guyton, the deep shot to Mike Williams, I mean, those were very impressive throws. There was a throw that Mina Kimes highlighted, I highlighted, where Nate Tice highlighted, where he sort of slid to his left and then threw back to his right to hit Keenan. But the one that stuck out to me was he threw off of a run-pass option play, just a little seam route to Guyton up the right numbers. But what was most impressive about it was he had pressure coming off the right side, and he's coming off that run fake, and he's dropping into the pocket, but he sees the pressure, so he knows he has to hurry it up. And he just jams his right foot into the turf as he's backpedaling and then snaps and throws. And to have that kind of snap weight transfer where you're dropping into the pocket, you jab your back foot into the ground, and then you snap the hips and snap that throw, the weight transfer itself is impressive. But then to see him with the velocity he's still able to put when you're moving one way and snapping and throwing it back, it's just stuff you don't see every week. And so, you know, there's a reason why, whether they win or lose, you know, the Chargers and Justin Herbert are one of the first teams I watch every Monday morning to sort of break down and study, because what he's able to do throwing the football, it impresses me week in and week out. And it's why I think, like I talked about earlier, catering to what he does in the downfield passing game is going to be huge for them down the stretch and into the next couple of seasons.
Matchup of the week. I feel like you're going to Florida.
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's an easy one, right? But you get that Buffalo, you get that Tampa Bay game, you know, the late window on Sunday. And I think this will be a fascinating matchup, because where Monday night, where last night was an atmosphere and environment and a setting where I think Buffalo didn't want to be, you know, with the wind, going up against a team that you know is going to run the football, this is more on sort of equal footing from Buffalo's perspective, right? Because unless we get some sort of another weather anomaly kind of event, it's going to be good conditions to throw the football. It's a defense in Tampa Bay that you're not going to want to run against them. We saw that a couple of weeks ago. Frank Reich basically said, I'm not going to run against them. They're so good stopping the run, so they'll probably throw it 60 times. So you might see a combined, you know, 100 passing attempts in this game between Brady and Allen. I think that's going to be a really fun matchup to watch from a quarterback's perspective.
Schofield, we appreciate the time as always. We'll talk next week.
Thanks so much, guys. Always a blast. Have a great week.
All right. Don't mess up that pasta water next time.
I got to remember. Somebody on Twitter told me to put like a coffee mug or something next to the stove.
Yep.
So you won't forget, and just use that. And I love that tip, so I'm going to use that going forward.
All right. Good tip for everybody. Thanks for this, Mark. There is Mark Schofield, our favorite, joining us once a week here on the People Show. Update, Jason Spezza suspended for 6 games for kneeing Winnipeg's Neil Pionk. So that is the official word, not Mr. Booth. So for all those that got by Booth earlier today, so this is the official word.
So it was half of what Booth said.
Yes.
It was half. 12? And, yeah.
So that's official from NHL Player Safety. Coming up next, champions of the Canadian Premier League, Pacific FC, Pa Modu Ka joins us to kick off Hour 4 of the People Show on Sportsnet 650.